This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think what is important to mention, it's yes, there is a humanitarian crisis, but it's really a man-made disaster. Huh? It's a conflict that created all this humanitarian need today.
That's Christine Yame of Doctors Without Borders talking about the humanitarian crisis in Borno State, Nigeria. Details next. Also, to the hundreds of thousands of people who fled his country over the past 2 years, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza says, come home. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza is telling the hundreds of thousands of people who fled his country over the past 2 years to come home. During his visit to Tanzania yesterday, he said Burundi is now peaceful. Violence erupted in April 2015 after Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Up to 2,000 people may have been killed in Burundi. The UN says about 400,000 people fled to neighboring countries. More than 240,000 of them went to Tanzania. The UN and rights groups say the violence and human rights abuses continue. Tanzania's President John Magufuli also urged Burundian refugees in his country to go home. In a speech, he told them to prepare to return home, adding that he is not expelling them. Meanwhile, here in Washington, D.C., police say they do not suspect foul play in the disappearance of six Burundian teenagers. The teens had taken part in an international robotic competition. Police say two of the teens were reportedly seen crossing into Canada, but the whereabouts of the remaining four are not known. The students had been staying at a dormitory at Trinity Washington University. They were supposed to be under the close adult supervision and had been advised not to leave the dorm. However, wire services report the teens went missing Tuesday night, and event organizers then called police. Egyptian state media report insurgents attacked a three-vehicle police convoy outside of Cairo today, killing one officer and wounding three others. The convoy was attacked by gunmen while traveling on the Cairo to Fayuma Road. AP says state media report the gunmen fired from a plantation. As the rainy season takes hold in Nigeria's Borno State, humanitarian agencies are concerned about maintaining current levels of emergency aid. Borno State is part of the humanitarian crisis in northeastern Nigeria, brought on by years of insurgency by Boko Haram militants. Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, is one of the agencies helping the many people who've been displaced. Christine Yame is director of operations for MSF in Geneva. She spoke to VOH Jody Kapua about the current situation in Borno State.
Doctor Without Borders is working there now since more than a year. And definitely what we are facing is based to the conflict between the government and opposition, so-called Boko Haram, which of course create a lot of violence, a lot of displacement of population, which of course cannot plant as they used to do, cannot move freely as they used to do. So of course you have a full lot of people that are just coping with the conflict.
Now, you're concerned about the upcoming rainy season. What problems do you foresee?
The problem is you have some group of population which are gathered in some area with limitation of movement, but some of this area are inaccessible when it rains because the ground is very flat And you have some rivers that overflow, and it cut all the road of access to some area. Ran is an example. If you have more than 40,000 people, that when the rain will have fully speed up, it will be a kind of island. And you have no bridge in order to be able to provide services and assistance to this population.
What about disease outbreaks?
Yeah. Of course, with the rain, you have all the malaria as well, which is arriving, which is a disease transmitted by a mosquito. And of course, more you have water, more you have mosquito. And this mosquito is biting people and, of course, infecting people with malaria, and which is a deadly disease, especially on the small kids that are more vulnerable, on the pregnant women that are more vulnerable as well. So that is one major issue. The second one as well, it's when it's flooded all around, you will have a lot of water and sanitation issue. So you will have overloading of toilets, so mixing of water with waste and excreta and whatsoever, which is, of course, a big vector of disease, but any kind of diarrheal disease. So the condition, of course, deteriorate with the rain.
I understand there's also a hepatitis E outbreak in some areas.
Yeah, absolutely. You are totally right. So we have outbreaks that have been declared in some part of Borno. So it's as well a waterborne disease. And it's, of course, more important when you have problem of water because you need to clean up the water and you don't have proper treatment for hepatitis E. There is a vaccination which is existing, but we have not been able to vaccinate and to prevent people to get the disease. So meaning that we will end up by just managing the cause and the consequences of the disease. So we are doing it, but when it's flooded, when it's raining, of course, the conditions are much more complicated and it means that you will have much more contamination.
You had mentioned a figure of 40,000 earlier in the interview. Overall, how many people do you see at risk?
Oh, that's a good question, because since a year we have managed to access some area, some more easily than others, but there is still a full part of the state that we don't have access and we don't know what is happening. We don't know if there is still population. If there is still population, we don't know in which condition they are. We are in the middle of a conflict, a population where we have been able to deploy assistance. I'm sure it's better than how it was 1 year ago, but still, it's half of the population that we can assist. We don't know where they are, and we don't have access to them.
How much time do you have to prepare before the rainy season arrives?
Let's be clear, the rainy season has already started, but it's not full speed of the rainy season. So now we are in full speed of pre-positioning, of making sure that the stock are ready, that we will have enough supply in order to provide medical care during the whole season of the rainy season. But now, in the coming days, the full rain will come.
You mentioned that you were very concerned about water and sanitation, and it seems like the number of latrines is actually a problem.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, in terms of international standard, we usually say that you have to have one latrine for maximum 20, 25 people. And at the moment, we have a little bit less than 300 persons per latrine. So you can imagine that, of course, not everybody is using a latrine. If you have to queue for the latrine, you still have some people that do use open field, which, of course, when it's raining, it's a major issue.
Now, of course, MSF is always in the most volatile areas. How concerned are you about security in that region?
We are in a conflict area, so there is still fighting going on. There is still area where we do not have access and we don't know what is happening. So, of course, not all the state is at the same level. And you have some places that have improved compared to 1 year ago, but there is still some places which is kind of enclave that are not accessible. We would like to be able to go, but it's not yet authorized for us. I think what is important to mention, it's yes, there is a humanitarian crisis, but it's really a man-made disaster. It's a conflict that created all this humanitarian need today.
Christine Yamay is Director of Operations for MSF in Geneva. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. to the hundreds of thousands of people who fled his country over the past 2 years, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza says, come home. Insurgents attacked a three-vehicle police convoy outside of Cairo today, killing one officer and wounding three others. And as the rainy season takes hold in Nigeria's Borno state, humanitarian agencies are concerned about maintaining current levels of emergency aid. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In 2015, the famous Cecil the Lion was killed by a trophy hunter in northwest Zimbabwe. The incident caused an international uproar after Cecil strayed out of a protected area and was shot. Now, there is word that Cecil's cub, a six-year-old lion named Zanda, has also been killed by a trophy hunter. The AFP says Zanda also appears to have wandered outside the Hwange National Park and was killed on July 7th. Both Cecil and his son had been wearing GPS tracking collars. While the hunter who killed Cecil was publicly identified as an American, the identity of the trophy hunter who killed Zanda has not been revealed. Up to 2.7 million pangolins are hunted each year in Central Africa, pushing some species closer to extinction. A new study says hunting the world's most illegally traded mammal has skyrocketed. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The pangolin, or scaly anteater, is relentlessly hunted for food, traditional medicine, and even fashion. In fact, they're even more sought after than ivory. And like ivory, China is the biggest market for pangolin parts. Jan Charleman of the University of Sussex is co-author of the study.
The pangolins are extremely endangered and are nearly extinct in Asia. And we're wondering what's happening to the pangolins in Africa. And it's very much kind of this notion that there had been lots of individual studies documenting the decline of pangolins in Africa, but no one had really pieced all the puzzle pieces together and kind of provided a big overview looking at what's happening across the entire continent.
The professor of conservation science says researchers looked at 70 studies and other pangolin data.
The demand for pangolins has increased dramatically, so there's been a 150% increase of individuals hunted in Central African forest from 1970s to 2014.
Those forests spread across Cameroon, Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Republic of Congo. It's estimated the number of pangolins hunted every year in those forests ranges from 400,000 to 2.7 million. But since there are no solid figures on the pangolin population, it's not known how long they can hold out against the hunters. But Charleman thinks their prospects are dim.
We got some information on some studies which showed us the age distribution of the pangolins, individuals which were hunted, and 45%, so nearly half of them, are actually juveniles or subadults. So those are pangolins which haven't yet had a chance to breed or produce offspring. So it's likely that the harvesting is unsustainable.
Pangolins are hunted with snares, traps, and guns. They're usually dead by the time hunters reach them, even if they wanted to release a juvenile animal. The Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species, or CITES, approved a total ban on international trade of pangolins last September.
So legally, there shouldn't be any international trade happening anymore, but obviously it takes quite a bit of time to enforce that law and kind of implement it on the ground.
And he says local laws could be better enforced.
There are some laws across most Central African countries forbidding the snaring of pangolins. But still, we found that about 50% of the pangolins we had in our sample, where we had information on the hunting method, were trapped by traps or by snares, actually. So even the local laws aren't necessarily implemented or enforced.
The University of Sussex-led study appears in Conservation Letters. It was a collaborative effort involving many universities, conservation agencies, and government ministries. Charlemagne says some field workers even risk their lives gathering the information, living for months in the forests. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Adequate water supply to one of Africa's most important economies, South Africa's metropolis of Johannesburg, could be in danger in the near future. This follows repeated delays to an extension of the Lesotho Highlands Water Project. In 1998, it began channeling the life-giving liquid from water-rich mountainous Lesotho to catchments in neighboring water-scarce South Africa. A serious drought in that country the past few years highlighted its need for more water, especially in Gauteng. This province is South Africa's industrial and financial heartland and generates more than a third of the nation's annual GDP. Darren Taylor reports.
Johannesburg's main water source, the massive Vaal Dam, fell to a quarter of its capacity during the drought last year. Civil engineer Mike Miller recalls that when city officials implemented the necessary water-saving restrictions, many residents panicked.
What they didn't know is that the Sterkfontein Dam was 90% full, and it's actually a bigger dam than the Vaal Dam.
Miller specializes in facilitating effective water management around the world, including for the United Nations. The Sterkfontein Reservoir, about 200 miles southeast of Johannesburg, can also provide it with water during dry periods.
So the strategic reserve was still up there, and the restrictions were introduced just to make sure that even if the drought went on for another 2 years, there would have been enough water to see the cities and the businesses through the problem.
But even mega dams are no longer enough for South Africa's growing infrastructure needs.
The population is growing, water consumption is growing, but the system which has got to supply all these people and all these activities isn't growing.
Miller is specifically referring to Phase 2 of the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, the Polihali Dam. It was scheduled for completion next year. Miller and his counterpart in Lesotho negotiated this when he was South Africa's Director General of Water Affairs from 1997 to 2005.
That's the project that's late. That's the project which should have been built right now, and we haven't even started designing it because the politicians want to make sure that their friends get the jobs, and they're going to put the whole society at risk as a result.
Experts estimate it'll cost around 30 billion rand, about $2 billion, to construct the Polihali Dam. Graft has tainted it even before its first brick has been laid. In 1999, a court in Maseru found that several multinational firms had bribed Lesotho's chief of the scheme to win tenders to build the dam. The government fired him. In South Africa, investigators are probing contracts awarded to a firm that funds the ruling ANC party. Miller says entities on both the Lesotho and South African sides are still competing intensely for big tenders.
Unfortunately, what's happened is that the politicians have got interested in these decisions. And instead of taking the decisions at the right time and starting the work at the right time, they still haven't started the design of the projects that will be needed in 2019-2020.
The Lesotho and South African administrators insist the best contractors are being chosen to construct the new dam in a revamped process free of corruption. They say the Polihali Reservoir will now be completed in 2025. Miller's experience tells him this will not happen, but that even if it does, tragedy, as he puts it, remains possible across Southern Africa.
We're actually at serious risk if there's a drought, say in 2020, that goes on for 4 years. We will not come out of it nearly as well as we've come out of the present one.
Without the Polihali Dam's water, says Miller, such a dry period could cause millions of people in the region to go hungry because a succession of maize harvests in South Africa would fail. Industry dependent on water would stall, leading to grave economic stagnation and job losses in economies already suffering major unemployment. I am Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The UN says women and children's health is improving faster than any point in history. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on a massive program that has saved countless lives.
More women are surviving childbirth, and more children are surviving childhood, even in the poorest of nations. It's the result of a UN-backed initiative called Every Woman, Every Child. Launched in 2010, it brings together more than 800 organizations, including the World Health Organization.
More women are receiving services of care, skilled care during birth, more antenatal care, more postpartum care. Children are receiving more vaccines than ever before.
Governments and private organizations invested more than $45 billion to improve women's survival during pregnancy and childbirth. The funding helped train midwives, improve nutrition for women, children, and adolescents. It provided education, better sanitation, and clean water. The result? Since 1990, the world's maternal death rate has fallen by 44%. Another achievement, death rates of children under 5 declined by more than 50%. Together, they are great humanitarian achievements. It also makes sense economically. Governments save money that is normally spent fighting disease, and healthy people contribute more to a country's wealth. The return on investment is high.
Every kind of investment on women, children, adolescent is an immense resource for the countries and the GDP.
Nearly all preventable deaths among women, children, and adolescents occur in low- to middle-income countries. In 2015, more than 300,000 women died during pregnancy and childbirth. Most deaths could have been prevented. Also that year, nearly 6 million children under age 5 died, mainly from avoidable causes. That's 16,000 children dying every day. The goal now is to improve on the program's success. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Coming up this Sunday, family picnic time. You heard me. I'm bringing you 55 minutes of pure, commercial-free, pan-African music that's all made by musical families. Global rep for Ghana, we don't slow. Fathers and sons, brothers, sisters, identical twins, husbands and wives, it's one big musical family gathering. So tune in and feast your ears this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. It's Music Time in Africa. Cheers!
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa,
We'll discuss Rwanda's August 4th presidential election. Incumbent Paul Kagame is widely expected to win another term. The amended constitution allows him to remain in power until 2034 if he pursues it. A preview of Rwanda's presidential election.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.